This idea of the apocalypse, the end, capitalized, has been with us for a long time, gets mentioned all the time. I mean, as far back as the Bible and Revelations, I don't know how many remember this, the Jupiter effect, which was something that was going around in the early 80s, how all the planets were lined up and it was going to cause massive earthquakes and volcanoes on the Earth. And then there was, of course, Y2K and all the dire predictions about that, the Mayan calendar. Man, remember that 2012 end of the world, all that stuff? Or how about Hail Bop, The Stand, you know, Stephen King's pandemic, or The Road, or you turn on a television, you can't help but see zombies pretty much everywhere on television and movies. We're always seemingly thinking about the end of the world. And along comes Brian Walsh, a Princeton grad who spent 15 years working as a foreign correspondent, reporter, and editor for Time magazine, traveled all over the world, 20 different countries, reporting on science and environmental stories, global warming, extinction. He started thinking about the end when he became a dad, and he's written the ultimate book, End Times, a brief guide to the end of the world, looking at asteroids, supervolcanoes, rogue robots, and a lot more, including aliens. We're going to get to that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Brian Walsh wrote End Times, the brief guide to the end of the world, looking at all kinds of existential threats to our lives, our collective lives. And, you know, for as dire a subject as this is, the book is immensely entertaining. And Brian, I'd have to say you don't take it easy on the legitimacy of these threats, but at least you have hope on the sort of the other side of the rainbow. Welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You mentioned in the book that you started looking at the future when you became a dad. You had traveled all over the world working for Time, seen a lot of really bad stuff, and started pondering the idea of not only the continuation of your line, but the continuation of humanity itself, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'd spent years in different parts of the world. You know, I'd seen epidemics up close. I'd seen, you know, nuclear tensions, and I'd reported on climate change and the environment for years. And I was always sort of circling around the subject. And then, you know, I realized I just wanted to really try to bring it all together, look at all those different kind of risks, and definitely becoming a father, knowing that was going to happen. And then when my son was born, kind of brought it home in a way, in a much more real way, I think, than it was when you're just reporting on it. It really made me think about the future, and this book, at the end of the day, obviously it matters to us, you know, what's going to happen to the world that we live on right now, but it really matters for not just our children, but their children, and then so forth and so on. There has to be people now for there to be a future at all, really.
Early in the book, you reference polls, different kinds of polls about how many people think the end times are upon us, or we're getting pretty close, or they'll see it in their lifetimes. And the numbers are astonishing. And yet, I don't remember where this is in the book, but I remember reading a section where you mentioned how humans seem instinctively to have trouble really getting their heads around an existential type threat and what it means.
Yeah, I think as you said at the top, you know, the sense that is this going to be the end? Are we near the end? It's always sort of present with humanity, and every generation takes different kind of forms. It might be religious in the past, it might be political another time. You know, it might be technological, I think, increasingly now. But that means there's a difference between, I think, that sort of sense that things are going to spin out of control, or almost a self-centered sense that things have to end with us, versus actually being able to really understand the kind of numbers we're talking about. The human mind, just when you start thinking beyond really small numbers, or, you know, beyond the present day, we just don't really do it. You know, we can't really fathom what it's like, 1 billion people, 2 billion people. At the same time, it's also really hard to think 50 years in the future, 70 years in the future. You know, I know even if you're thinking about yourself, you know, and you think about yourself in the future, it's like you're thinking about a stranger, you know? So you can imagine then trying to really care and comprehend what's going to happen to people who don't even live yet. That's just something we're not really set up to do, I think, almost, you know, from evolution's sake.
Yeah, you know, we all know when we think about it that no one gets out of here alive, that we're all going to die someday. But the idea of everyone else dying at the same time or when we go is really sobering and unsettling for us if we take the time to stop and think about it. There's an excerpt you have in the beginning of your book from something else called The Children of Men, which was made for a great movie. And the author there wrote that of the 4 billion life forms which have existed on the planet, 3.96 billion of those, or 3.69 billion of those, are now extinct. And why should humans think any differently? I mean, I guess at some point we're going to go.
At some point, sure. I mean, that's been the history of just about every species on this planet when you look far enough. And that's another thing that's hard for us to grasp is the kind of distances of time that you talk about when you look at the scope of this entire planet. I mean, human beings, the few thousand years essentially we've even had anything like civilization is just a tiny, tiny portion of that time. And you're right, you know, this is going to happen to all of us as individuals, and we can kind of maybe begin to grasp that. But I think what that passage and other ones sort of point out is we actually do care, you know, about there being a future, that there's something, if, you know, we were to suddenly find out that, you know, in 15 years' time, it'll all go away, I think it'd be very hard for us to go on, you know, because we count on the idea that there will be something around us after we go. And if that were somehow taken away from us, it would really remove, I think, a lot of the meaning we feel with our lives, the fact that we're working on things that go beyond us. We're not really that self-centered at the end of the day. We do care about that. It's just hard to sometimes translate that sort of internal sense of caring into, okay, well, let's actually begin to take policies that might make a difference on that kind of time scale.
You write that, make no mistake, we are in mortal danger. I mean, these things that you write about are not pie in the sky. They're all very real, and any one of them, let alone any combination of them, could do the deed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what really makes the difference about where we are right now is, on one hand, you know, you have those kind of background natural threats that have always been out there. You know, there's always been a possibility that, just as happened to the dinosaurs 66 million years ago, that an asteroid with our name on it could be on the collision course with the Earth, or, you know, a supervolcano, this volcanic activity that's wiped out life in the past on this planet before, could strike. But what's different is that now we're creating new risks. You know, we have things like nuclear war, which have been with us for some time, things like climate change, the environment that are accelerating. But then you even look at new technologies we're bringing in, whether it's AI, whether it's things we can do with biology increasingly. So we're not just dealing with that background danger in the universe, but we're also actively creating new things for ourselves, sometimes completely by accident. You know, often with these new technologies, it's not like creating a bomb. It's creating something that could do a lot of good, but also carries a background risk of something going very, very, very badly.
I'd like to start with AI, even though that's not where the book starts, because I don't know if you got to hear any of our first guests tonight talking about the possibility of intelligent design and the threat of artificial intelligence. You do a great job of explaining how real that threat is. There's a section where you say that you quote a Silicon Valley luminary saying that AI will be more important than electricity or fire. And it is so seductive, the idea of, I think Ray Kurzweil is the guy that talks about the singularity, uploading our consciousness to a computer and living forever, in essence, and saying goodbye to our pain and our physical limitations. That's very seductive and appealing, but AI is a legitimate existential threat, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, and it takes lots of different forms. You often hear, you know, people like Ray Kurzweil talk about the singularity, and that's an idea that, you know, we'll be able to create AI that will surpass us very quickly, that, you know, will be not just as smart as a human being, but rapidly, because of its ability to learn and evolve so quickly, it would surpass us. And some people like Ray Kurzweil think that could be a great thing. You know, it could open up a whole new way of life, even immortality. But a lot of other experts are worried that, you know, just as we are the top species on this planet, not because we're faster or stronger than everything else on this planet, but because we're smarter, if we were to create something that was not just smarter than us, but, you know, orders of magnitude smarter than us, that could be, we could be in danger of being replaced in some way, whether it's, you know, again, by accident or on purpose, we don't really know, but that's one thing to worry about. But even before we get to that stage, the idea of these new AI programs being integrated into some of the ways we live and do politics now is dangerous. The idea it could be connected to weapon systems creates a new risk around something like nuclear war that was even greater than it was when human beings were in charge of it. And you can think of a few other ways like that. So even without the sort of really outside-the-box Ray Kurzweil kind of AI, it's going to make things more dangerous, in part because it'll make things move faster, and we don't always do well when things move very fast and more unpredictable.
There's a section where you quote Alan Turing talking about the first ultra-intelligent machine is the last invention that man need ever make. You know, there's a race right now to make that machine. Breakthroughs by the U.S. is trying to do it. China's trying to do it. Corporations are trying to do it. We have to worry about whose hands that technology gets into first, and also as well as how ultimately to handcuff it so that it doesn't turn on us. And do you think you obviously have to be concerned about both of those issues?
Absolutely. I mean, we know what it's like when you have countries get involved in a race to develop a technology that's, you know, potentially gives you almost power over the rest of the planet. I mean, we saw that again with nuclear weapons, and that created decades of intense danger, intense risk. And I think AI presents the same kind of challenge on an international level when you have the U.S., when you have China really talking very openly about almost like a new kind of AI Cold War, you know, and that's something I think we should be worried about. And then the idea that we can somehow protect ourselves, that's very hopeful, you know, but it's hard sometimes for me to see, you know, it's hard enough to see how you might develop really super intelligent AI. That's a leap forward from what we have now. But if you are able to do that, the idea of putting in some kind of balance, some kind of check against it, that's potentially incredibly difficult as well, because you have to solve all kinds of ethical challenges. You have to solve all kinds of control challenges. So, you know, the worst kind of scenario would be something where you create something incredibly powerful, but have no real governance around it, no kind of break you could put on it. And that's kind of a little worried where I'm headed now, because you have that race. Because when you do have a race, you think less about, you know, how you're running it and more whether or not you're going to win.
Yeah, when I think of AI, I think of Skynet. You know, how do you build a machine that's so much smarter than we are and keep it from hacking itself so that it exceeds whatever limits we put on it?
I'm not sure we really know how, actually. You know, I think the one expert I cite in the book says essentially, you know, to figure out how to create safe, super intelligent AI, you need to solve all the problems in philosophy. And we've been working on that for a few thousand years, and, you know, we're still pretty far away from getting to it. So it's easier in some ways to see how you create it in a powerful way, much harder to see how you make it happen in a safe way. And again, if you're doing it while you're both trying to race towards it, then you're almost certainly going to disregard those safety measures, whether you're talking about a country or a company as well. I mean, if you're talking about a Google or a Facebook, all these Silicon Valley companies that are investing billions of dollars in AI, you know, paying AI researchers salaries in the millions of dollars, you know, their interest is in getting it over their competitors, you know, because if you can manage that, the competitive advantage you would have would just be mind-blowing. And so, you know, there's not a whole lot within that being spent, you know, in terms of dollars on safety, but also I think it's just not something that's foremost in the developers' minds, although that is beginning to change, which is one good thing. You know, all these sort of people warning about this is beginning to have an impact, and you at least have AI scientists talking about, okay, how do we create it safely? Are there sort of some kind of, you know, sort of fail-safe that could be put in to ensure that things don't get out of control?
If someone made a breakthrough, if Bezos made a breakthrough, I mean, I wonder how soon we might know about it. You would think that would be pretty tempting to go ahead and use a company.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It would be tempting to go ahead and use it. But at the same time, you know, maybe you wouldn't even know it was being used. You know, one of the things about when you start thinking about what a super intelligent AI could do is it really starts to, like, dealing with someone with superpowers almost. You know, it could be doing it in a secret way. And in some ways, we're already seeing aspects of that. You know, you see, you know, comparatively narrow or less advanced AI being used around social messaging. You know, we've seen an election hacking effort. So you can imagine how potentially, if it existed, someone might not want to announce it like overnight, but rather just be able to take advantage of it, you know, economically, you know, for better planning and so forth. And it might even be able to cover its tracks in that way. You know, it really challenges the mind to kind of like think through these kind of scenarios, because it would be like unlike anything we've ever really had to deal with technology on this planet before.
Yeah, we couldn't just pull the plug on it. I mean, it would be presumably ultra Machiavellian if it's really that much smarter than us.
That's actually not a bad way to look at it. I mean, you know, something has intelligence if it can sort of create a plan, follow through that plan to achieve some kind of objective. And you could have a situation where, you know, you programmed the AI to have some kind of objective that you think is actually good, and it could go about achieving that in the most efficient way possible, which is really what AI is. It's about something like, where do I find the most efficient path to any kind of goal, whether it's, you know, manage a factory or it's play a chess game. And you could have a situation where it simply follows through those objectives in a way that's bad for us. You know, I mean, that would be something I would be concerned about, is that you could program it in such a way, but in the sort of the same you know, I use the example of the Sorcerer's Apprentice in the book. It's kind of a parable where, you know, you try to do something and it has all these unintended side effects. That's something I would be very concerned around with AI.
Let's go to where you begin the book, which was with asteroids. And you make reference to two of the most popular movies that paint different scenarios about the asteroid threat, the Deep Impact and Armageddon, which, you know, they both have very different endings. But this is a very real threat. And although, you know, if you only casually read newspaper articles about it, seems like we've made a lot of progress in detecting the really big ones that are out there. You make a pretty strong case that there are some significant threats that we just don't see coming, even with the progress that we've made.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we know it's always been it's happened in the planet's past. You know, we've even had smaller impacts in the course of human history. So it's definitely something that's out there. And we have made a lot of actual progress. You know, since the 90s, since this really came home as a threat, you know, we've had situations where now you have a space car program for NASA that's found, you know, north of 90% of all the asteroids out there that could potentially threaten the Earth that are bigger than a kilometer, about 0.6 miles. And that's remarkable. But, you know, there are tons more smaller ones out there that we're trying to keep track of. You know, we've found, I think, north of 18,000 so far. But, you know, we miss ones all the time. In fact, just I believe earlier this month there was an asteroid large enough that had it collided on the planet that's big enough to destroy a city that passed within about 45,000 miles of Earth, and no one even knew it was there until it had already made that pass by. So for all the effort to go and try to search for things, it still is very hard to find everything out there. And that makes us vulnerable to being caught off guard. You know, it makes us vulnerable to not catching something until it might be too late for us to actually do anything about it. So we know we're looking, but that doesn't mean we're finding everything that's potentially out there.
There was an article in a British newspaper. We posted it to our website tonight. It was, I think the article was yesterday, but it's talking about an asteroid that's 10 or 12 years out that's calculated to be within 19,000 miles. That's under some satellites, according to the article. That's a pretty close shave. And you also referenced the videos. I remember seeing them when they happened, of these things that exploded, these fireballs that came in over Russia in the last couple of years. Just no one saw them coming at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one in over Russia, I believe in 2013, is a great example. That's literally the day before some NASA scientists were really trumpeting the fact they had managed to track another asteroid. You know, had seen it coming towards the Earth, knew how close it was going to come. It was considered a really great success and prediction. And then, you know, suddenly over the skies of Chelyabinsk in Russia, you know, one of the most secretive areas of the country, you know, where a lot of nuclear work is actually done, suddenly, boom, big meteorite exploding in the sky. And that caught a lot of people off guard. And that is another reminder that, you know, these risks can be connected. I think, you know, Russia at the time was a little concerned that might actually be without a nuclear attack. It looks like one. It blows up in the sky in the same one. And you can easily see how one could get misunderstood if you don't see them coming. You know, if it comes off guard, not only do you risk the idea of an impact, but it could be mistaken for something else, and that would be even worse.
You wrote in the book about the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, and it's generally accepted as absolutely true. But I had never seen this before, that there was some bad luck involved in that fact that where it landed. And, of course, we know about Tunguska, how lucky the planet was that one landed in the middle of nowhere and killed trees instead of hitting New York City or London or something. But the dinosaurs weren't so lucky. This was about as bad as it gets.
Right. Where it hit was a sort of shallow part of the ocean where there was a really heavy concentration of sulfur. And so when it hits that area, it kicks up vast amounts of debris, including all these sulfates in the atmosphere. And it creates kind of a cloak around the planet that brought about eventually sort of very intense warming and then really rapid cooling. And there was just no way for the dinosaurs or a lot of the rest of the life on the planet to really endure that. But had it, you know, hit somewhere else on the Earth, it would have still caused immense devastation, because we're talking about an asteroid, you know, wider than 6 miles, which is quite huge. But, you know, we might not have seen, you know, the climate change effects that we saw to the same degree, and maybe, you know, we'd still have dinosaurs still here. You know, you never know. I mean, that sort of shows how, you know, to get hit in that way really requires a lot of bad things all to happen.
We're talking with Brian Walsh, author of End Times. When you're dealing with the kind of apocalyptic scenarios described by Brian Walsh in his book End Times, maybe there's no place to go. If you thought that the killer asteroid sounded bad, Wait till we get into the facts about super volcanoes. That's coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. Brian Walsh, before we move on from the subject of killer asteroids, can you describe the scenario? What happens? Worst case scenario, one of these big rocks hits a bad place. What happens to most humans in that scenario?
Well, I think in the worst case scenario, again, you're talking, and we'll use the example of the dinosaurs as one, since we actually saw it happening. You know, obviously, it's a massive destruction on the ground around the impact site, especially obviously if it occurs inland or anywhere near a populated area. But, you know, those longer term effects is what we'd have is debris being sent into the atmosphere. You'd have other chemicals sent into the atmosphere. You'd have what's called an impact winter, essentially. You'd see sudden, really drastic cooling, you know, 15, 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and that would continue over the course of years, potentially. And that's really where you get the, I suppose, end the world effect, because how would it be possible to grow food in that kind of environment? So, you know, that's really the apocalypse kind of scenario that you foresee when you're talking about a massive asteroid hitting.
I guess you could imagine some people living in caves and surviving it or underground if they had enough food stored away, or you don't think so?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, it's you know, there's something called the last person problem when you're looking at this kind of subject academically, really, which is, you know, there's a lot of human beings out there. We spread all throughout the entire climate of the planet, so we're very hard to kill off fully. So, yes, that might be possible. It'd be hunter-gatherers who are actually more attuned to that kind of way of life that would be, you know, from the post-collapse of civilization, might actually be able to withstand that and survive and start this whole thing up over again. But it's one of those situations where it'd be very hard, I think, you know, depending on how long it lasts, for even those kind of people to survive. So without sort of some sort of preparation, some people actually put in a safe place, you know, it is possible to foresee something along the lines of human extinction.
You mentioned in the book that there really is a guy who has, this is a great title on his business card, I guess, planetary defense officer or coordinator. It's not Bruce Willis, but tell me about what we need in terms of detection and what would work if we detected something like what's described in the movie Armageddon. Could we deflect it? Would it take nukes? Would nukes even work?
So if, you know, the real step you need to improve detection is to put a telescope in space that would be focused on looking for this. You know, when you're looking at it mostly from land-based telescopes, so that presents issues. You can only obviously look at night. You're blocked in terms of the amount of the sky you can see. You know, there's weather and other impacts, none of which occurs with a space one. Now, there's a plan that's been on the books, but it's kind of been delayed, so it's not clear if it's actually going to happen. And then when it comes to actually what would you do in the event you saw one and you had time to act, you know, years before it was like an impact with the Earth, you could actually do something somewhat similar to Armageddon. And the key there is, yes, nuclear weapons would be the most likely weapon to be used. And yes, you actually would put it into the asteroid. You know, ideally, you wouldn't blow it up next to it to maximize the destructive power. You would actually put it somewhat, you know, into the rock itself and try to blow it up that way, and not with the idea of turning into smithereens, you know, blowing it up like it's missile command or something like that, but rather you just do that to slow its momentum down somewhat, and then it just misses the Earth. It's a bit, you know, it was the comparison put to me was like, you know, we have two cars merging on a highway. That's the Earth and the asteroid. Can't change the speed of the Earth, obviously. So if you can just change the speed of the asteroid instead of colliding, you know, one will get there first and they'll miss each other. And that's ultimately what we try to do. Theoretically, we can do it. It's just we've never really tried to do that, and it would be helpful to take a test run, for instance, before you actually need to do it for real.
You, in that section where you talk about the threat from killer asteroids, you get into the math of end times. That's what your phrase for it. I think that could probably, the point that you make there could apply to all of the existential threats that you describe, is that we're really not putting enough money into it, into dealing with any of them. And maybe it's partially, what the heck, I'll be dead, what do I care? And maybe it's for some people, it's the rapture. I'm going to heaven, and people just don't want to put resources into it.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a lot of different motivations there, or counter motivations. Maybe, you know, if you're talking about politicians, I mean, they tend to focus on the time frames in which they're going to be in office, and these are all time frames that extend way beyond that. You know, when you look at, like I said, the risk, the math of existential risk, you really need to look over thousands and thousands of years, you know, because that's how likely any of these are to happen. I mean, they're not something that's terribly likely to happen tomorrow, but they will happen over a longer period of time. But there's no motivation to actually act on that. There's always some other sort of priority that comes up first, which is understandable. But when you really think about what it would mean, even trying to put an economic number on it, to lose most of the planet, the whole planet, the future as well, then it becomes, even with a tiny, tiny probability, it's worth spending significantly more than we do now. About, in this case, asteroids, about, I don't know, 60 million or so goes to that office per year. You know, could easily see a situation where you can raise it, triple it, which is something actually the White House has raised as a possibility. And still, I think, from the cost-benefit analysis, come out really ahead. It's just very unlikely you'll ever need to use it. So if you're a politician who wants to spend that money, what do you actually point to? It's not like you can say, oh, you know, this is happening right now. Instead, you have to say, like, we have to do this to prevent it from ever happening. And we rarely get a lot of credit for preventing something from happening versus actually acting on it after the fact.
Yeah, it's kind of like 9/11. I mean, there are hints that terrorists are planning some bad stuff, that they're trying to do really bad things. But until they succeed in bringing down the Twin Towers, we don't really get serious about it. And maybe it's going to take an asteroid to wipe out a city before we put enough money into it to keep an eye out for other ones that might be headed our way.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. I mean, something like 9/11, you know, some people knew it existed as a threat. They could even imagine it. But for most policymakers, certainly for most people, the idea how it would be carried out, the consequences were just outside the frame of reference. You know, and if it's outside that frame of reference, then, you know, even though it's very low probability, we kind of treat it as zero. You know, the thing with human beings is that, you know, we tend to see things as either likely or not really going to happen. It's kind of either yes or no. And with these things, very unlikely, but very unlikely is not the same thing as zero, and they shouldn't be treated that way. And yet that's often the case with a lot of these risks.
Let's transition to super volcanoes. I have a scene in my head of Woody Harrelson in the movie 2012, standing in Yellowstone, waiting for the massive eruption that kills him and all kinds of millions of other people. And, you know, I've read about the threat from the Yellowstone volcano and other super volcanoes. And like most people, I haven't really paid attention to it. This the chapter where you describe this stuff really got my attention. This is really this needs to be focused on.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is actually has a higher probability than asteroids. Asteroids get most of the attention because, you know, we know about the story of the dinosaurs, and, you know, there's something sort of cinematic about that happening. But in reality, if you look back over the history of the planet, their mega volcanic activity has been responsible for far more in the way of major extinction events than asteroid impacts. And, you know, Yellowstone has erupted twice over the last, I think, 2 or 3 times over the last 2.1 million years. And it's there. I mean, it's still an active system. Anyone who goes to Yellowstone sees the geysers, you know, hears it, they know it's real, and that's what it's coming from. And we can model that sort of eruption out, and it's something similar, actually, to what I said with the asteroids. You have tons of debris put into the atmosphere. You have sulfates and chemicals, and that creates, again, massive global cooling, no farming, and the same kind of terrible effect. It's just something that's actually, on a geologic scale at least, happens much more frequently than a situation like an asteroid impact.
And something short of an existential wipeout could still be really bad. And you've got several examples in the book where it caused massive migrations of humans because their homeland was wiped out, or their farmland was wiped out, or there are entire summers that become winter, economic effects that are felt globally.
Absolutely. I mean, I used the example of the Tambora volcanic eruption. This was in Indonesia in 1815, and that was a 7 on the volcanic explosivity index, which is kind of the Richter scale for volcanoes. Supervolcanoes are 8 out of 8 on that scale. But even Tambora, you know, that was enough to have global effects. I mean, the next year they called it, you know, here in the U.S. and in Europe, the year without summer, because you just had cooling that was palpable, had a huge impact on farming. You saw famine on the rise. You saw disease. You saw people trying to escape, you know, refugees moving, big pulse of migration to the U.S., elsewhere in Europe, and that was based off something that happens more on the scale of every few hundred years, you know, so that's something that could happen easily tomorrow, you know, where if it doesn't happen tomorrow, the idea that we might get through another century without something like that seems pretty unlikely. And, you know, on one hand, we're better, you know, in better shape than we were probably in 1815 to deal with something like this. But on the other hand, we're also much more connected, you know, so if something goes bad in one part of the world, it really has a knock-on effect that was much more the case than 200 years ago. And I think that should worry us. We saw, even if you remember, with the Icelandic volcano, I'm not back in 2010, you know, that was not a huge volcano, but you remember it had big impacts on global air travel. So that kind of shows how, you know, nature can have these mega disasters, and they have impacts that vary depending on where we are in the world, where we are technologically, how connected we are. So that's something I'm pretty concerned about. Unfortunately, unlike asteroids, it's not like you can shoot it out of the sky. We don't really have a means yet to stop anything like this from erupting. The best thing we can do is try to monitor it as closely as possible and at least be prepared if we know something's going to happen.
You mentioned several times in the book about the doomsday clock, and I remember seeing it as a kid when I used to do the duck and cover kind of episodes in schools, and you're too young for that, of course, but the doomsday clock is still around, and it moves back and forth depending on tensions in the world. And although it measures probably a variety of different kind of tensions, it usually boils down to a possible nuclear threat. We don't really think about a nuclear war. We're not thinking of going to the bunkers and duking it out with atomic weapons with the Russians all that much anymore. But the threat, as you paint in your book, is still very real.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's something that may not be on our radar in the same way it was for decades after World War II, but it absolutely is. If you were to say, you know, how will the world end tomorrow, almost certainly the most likely chance is a nuclear war. And it might be somehow on purpose. It might be most likely, actually, by accident, whether it's technical accident or human accident. But even though we've vastly reduced, you know, the number of warheads in the world from the darkest days of the Cold War, those tensions are hot. You know, they're very hot, hotter than they've been in years. And at the same time, you know, we now have far more countries with access to nuclear weapons now than we did during the Cold War, which means, you know, the risk of something going wrong increases. You know, it could be between India and Pakistan, for instance, two countries that have fought wars before in the 20th century, both have nuclear weapons now, you know, are very high alert now, actually, based off what's happening in Kashmir. And even though that would be maybe a limited, you know, in quotes, nuclear war between two countries that are geographically isolated from us, even that, some scientists believe, could be enough to trigger a pretty severe nuclear winter situation. Again, similar to what I said about volcanoes and asteroids, where you have global climatic effects that make, you know, that reduce temperature pretty quickly, keep it down for a number of years, and actually make farming much more difficult. And then you have starvation on a much broader scale. You're losing many, many people. But, you know, reality, the scary thing here is we don't actually know what would happen after one of these. You know, we don't know how bad it could get. You know, and I think the sheer amount of social disruption that would occur would be as bad as whatever would happen, you know, in the moment itself.
You referenced Dr. Strangelove, one of my favorite movies, and the scene that the Peter Sellers character based on, based on Edward Teller, in which there is a discussion in the bunker there about the command center about, you know, the scenario of winning a nuclear war. It's sort of acceptable losses under some scenarios. I guess I just didn't realize until I read this book that there really were folks who were discussing that option and how we'd be in a much better spot after a nuclear exchange. And I had never heard of the Daniel Ellsberg connection to that scenario. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah, so Daniel Ellsberg, of course, best known for leaking the Pentagon Papers. But, you know, he, for years, was a serious national security analyst, had access to pretty high-level papers and documents about nuclear war strategy in the late 50s and early 60s. And, you know, I believe it was 1961, he gets a hold of, you know, for the eyes of the president only, document that spells out U.S. war plans. And that was essentially bomb everyone in the event of an attack. And even just there, they were listing, you know, 100 million people dead in Eastern Europe, another 100 million probably in Western Europe based off spillover, obviously 100 million in Russia, but also China, too, even though they might not even be connected to that kind of attack. And that was added up to hundreds of millions of dead. That was probably almost certainly an underestimate. And when Daniel Ellsberg saw this, you know, he was just really shocked to the core, the idea that someone could just write this down in black and white as if it were a logical war strategy. And he actually ended up, when he was working on the Pentagon Papers, sort of copying that, he also took copies of those papers, and he was going to release them as well, but you know, there was obviously a lot of heat after the Pentagon Papers had been released, so he gave them to his brother in upstate New York for safekeeping. The brother buries them in the back of the yard. There's a hurricane comes in, washes them out. They're lost, and that was probably good for Daniel Ellsberg, because as much trouble as he was in for leaking the Pentagon Papers, he would have been far greater peril for prison time and who knows what else had they discovered that he had taken this as well. But, you know, now he's spent a lot of his time, and is in his late 80s at this point, talking about this threat, talking, you know, reminding us that it still exists, hasn't gone away, you know, and while we've reduced it in some ways, it's far from disappeared, and yet it's kind of fallen off the radar altogether. You only ever hear about it with something like North Korea or so forth. You rarely think about the fact that the United States and Russia still do have, you know, thousands of nuclear warheads pointed at each other, and they're set to go very quickly in the event of something going wrong. And that should really scare us, frankly. But and we've kind of come to focus on other things instead.
Yeah, I think you report that the number of nuclear weapons have gone reduced because of treaties and agreements, dropped from 70,000 or so down to about 14,000 nuclear weapons, which is great. But we've now exited our nuclear treaties. We've got Vladimir Putin boasting about these new super weapons, these hypersonic unstoppable weapons. Just a week ago, there's a giant explosion in a Russian missile factory that we think was likely a test to some new advanced system that didn't work out. This is a real threat. We're not shooting at Russians or we're not battling them over the Berlin Wall anymore, but clearly they're preparing for something.
Absolutely. You know, and then I think it's interesting, in the immediate days of the Cold War, it was the United States that was kind of counting on the idea of having a nuclear arsenal to counter a much bigger Soviet conventional military. And so we made it very clear, you know, if we saw tanks rolling, you know, across the Iron Curtain, we would respond with nuclear weapons. Now it's kind of, switched around. The U.S. conventional military is vastly superior to Russia, both in terms of just overall skill and technology and certainly in budget. The Russians actually are the ones counting on nuclear weapons as a backdrop. You know, so they're the ones threatening, like, we could do this in the event that something goes conventional. And that's concerning because, our nuclear weapon system is not in great shape either. You know, there's a lot of problems with it in terms of both personnel and the technology being used. But I'd be much more concerned with, obviously, what's going on in Russia. And we saw that with this apparent accident, apparently possibly a missile, you know, recently this month. And I would be very concerned that their system is just not ready for the rigors of that. And that maximizes, again, that chance of something going wrong. Because if you have one mistake, the system is set up to respond incredibly quickly. You know, it takes 30 minutes for an ICBM to get from Russia to the U.S. That leaves very little time, say, if you detect a launch or you detect something like that, to authenticate it and then respond. And we saw many times in the Cold War just that happening. You know, mistaken launches weren't launches, in fact, but they were initially scanned as such. And you actually had human beings sort of make a decision in the moment to not respond.
Yeah, there's one incident during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We'll talk about that on the other side. And then I want to ask you where we are on the doomsday clock now, and then get into disease and biotechnology, a lot of existential threats still to come, as we talk with Brian Walsh about his book, End Times, here on Coast to Coast.